Now the WGTD forecast from the National Weather Service on this Friday the 24th. Sunny and hot, high of 86. The new numbers are in. 74 degrees Racine and Kenosha, 64 for Burlington, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg up next.
And we welcome you to the Friday Morning Show on WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg. We're beginning Friday's morning show in very fun fashion indeed by speaking with none other than Dr. Kaboom. Dr. Kaboom, yeah. Also known, I suppose, on certain legal documents as David Epley, but we're calling him Dr. Kaboom today, is maybe we could call him a science comedian and entertainer. But Dr. Kaboom certainly takes science very seriously, although he has a lot of fun with it. In fact, there's a very serious mission behind the fun which he has with science, and particularly working with young people to engage them in science, namely to help people understand that science is for everybody. It's nothing to be scared of, although it's something we should be careful with, but science is something that is part of our lives and something that we need to better understand and appreciate. And he performs all across the country, and as a matter of fact, he's coming to southeastern Wisconsin this Sunday afternoon at 4 o'clock to George Williams College, to that beautiful setting known as Music by the Lake, for a performance Sunday afternoon at 4 o'clock. And you can get more information about that at musicbythelake.com. But in the meantime, I'm really excited to be able to spend a few minutes now via the telephone with Dr. Kaboom. We welcome you to the morning show.
Hello, my friend. Thank you very much. All that was extremely well said, by the way.
Well, I meant it all. And I've enjoyed what I've encountered of you on your website and all kinds of different video clips of you doing what you do. You have an interesting background, I understand, in which you, for a long time, aspired to be a serious professional scientist in all kinds of different realms. And then somehow left all that behind in order to go into a world of comedy, life of comedy, and then eventually returned to science.
The laboratory just isn't big enough for my ego, so I had to move it in onto a stage.
So how did that happen, that you felt this tug back to science, kind of your scientific roots? Did anything in particular cause that tug to occur?
No, it's really just a blending of two passions. I've been fortunate enough to, my first passion in life was science. It was the first thing that made my eyes get bigger and my heart beat faster. And I was always fortunate enough to have great classes on great professors. Even in high school, I went to a special high school for science and math students that you had to take the SAT to get into the high school. And then I became an actor after that because, people grow and change. But I always had in the back of my head that I wanted to bring that passion back into my life. So the passion of performing is one, but the deepest passion in my world is science. So putting those two together, putting it on stage, on traveling the world, reminding people that science is for everyone, has just made my life absolutely magnificent.
Hmm. So for someone who's not had the pleasure of actually seeing what you do, describe what a typical presentation by Dr. Kaboom is like.
Oh, yeah. Well, it's all live interactive comedy. The audience plays a part in the show, and every audience has a different group personality, so every show is a little bit different. Lots of improvisation happens in the course of the show. I take tabletop demonstrations, some that you may have seen in the past and some that I've made up completely on my own, and I make them very, very big. but occasionally ridiculously stupid. And we have a lot of fun. So there's a lot of, I bring students up on the stage, adults, children, whoever wants to volunteer, and we take the moments to make them the hero. One of my favorite pieces is where I demonstrate the scientific method by testing my hypothesis, my idea, that the catapult was not invented as a weapon of war, but as a way to feed the people. Yeah, so I bring someone up on stage and I fire bananas from the catapult until they catch one in the mouth. All along the way talking about the scientific process on making the young volunteer the hero of the moment.
Right. I noticed that in quite a number of the video clips that I've seen where you are working with a young person, it's quite often a young girl, although certainly you have boys come up as well. But I get the sense, and it wouldn't surprise me a bit, that you maybe take as a special mission to make sure that young girls understand that science is something that they should consider important, because, of course, we all read statistics about how girls at some point seem to start shying away from the sciences even more than boys do.
Yeah, it's true. It's true. It's true. I mean, I try to bring a nice cross-section of whoever the audience is up on stage, but it's very important to me because whenever you are, the science is about learning and about problem solving. And whenever you want to solve a problem, you want as many different perspectives coming in to solve that or to look at that situation as possible. And the women of the world have different perspectives than the men of the world. So I want to encourage all of us to come together in the sciences. Boys, girls, adults, children, we have a mindset in our country, the United States. I am a citizen, by the way. I have served honorably in the United States Army. I love my home. But we have a mindset where we act as if science is only for people who are already good at it. And that's hurting our nation. Our students are ranked worldwide 12th in science and 25th in mathematics. But our numbers are dropping. And so we've got to remind that somewhere around the middle school, people start to turn away from science because they think it's hard. So I like to point out that science is not hard. It takes effort, but that's not hard. That's just work. That's just part of life. And if you do the work, if you put in the effort, science is not hard. It's actually a great deal of fun.
Hmm. For those of you just joining us, I'm talking with Dr. Kaboom, also known as David Epley. Dr. Kaboom is coming to George Williams College this Sunday afternoon for a 4 o'clock performance as part of their Music by the Lake series. So, Dr. Kaboom, I wonder if you could give us your thoughts. I'm sure you have some opinions on this, on what it is that most scares people about science and causes them, so many people at least, at some point to sort of steer around science. And when does that typically happen for children, for instance? It seems like a lot of them begin intrigued by science, and then at some point, many children at least, begin to kind of wander away from it. When does that happen, and why do you think that happens?
Yeah, that's an excellent, excellent question. I think for most of us, in elementary school, science is exciting because all we see is the wow factor. On it, we do a little bit, and then there's something spectacular happens. As we get a little older and we start to learn more about science and the scientific process, the work of science comes into play. And it takes more work, more effort to get to that wow factor at the end. And sometimes you don't even get the wow factor because in science, it doesn't matter if you're right or wrong. It only matters that you learn. So sometimes you try things and they don't work. Whereas we as a culture are used to valuing having the answer. So when it becomes harder to get the answer, sometimes people turn away. But it's important to remember that it doesn't matter if you're right going into science. You have your idea, your hypothesis, you test it, you might be right, you might be wrong. It doesn't matter. We have a mindset. We think that scientists are supposed to know everything, and scientists are only supposed to know how to learn. And that's what science is. Now, on top of that, we have parents and adults who have been told that science is not for them, that science is only for certain people. We have young girls in the last generation who were told you can be anything you want, what you want to be. And if they said scientist, people said, oh, no, you can't be a scientist. You're a girl. So they've grown up into parents who have this mindset that science is only for other people. And my goal is to change that and remind people that science is like William Shakespeare. It's not something to be read. It's meant to be done. So I try to get people on their feet, actively involved, doing science together. Because when we start turning away in around eighth grade, ninth grade, that trend continues for the rest of one's life. We even have young adults in this country going to college, not taking science classes because in their mind it's too hard.
One of your guiding principles that you like to really talk about in your presentations is really intriguing. It speaks to that. One of the things you want people to know and understand and realize and remember is science is not hard, but it does take effort.
Yeah, we mix those up, and they're not the same thing. Effort is work. That's just part of life. Anything worth having in life is worth working for.
So tell us how you first got so interested in science as a youngster, because it sounds like from a very, very young age, science was what you loved almost more than anything.
Oh, yeah. When I was a small boy, I would take things apart all over the house because I wanted to know how they worked and why they worked. And this included plants. my curiosity was really piqued on how things happen. Usually I was able to put things back together. Of course, plants, not so much. But I always just wanted to know how things worked. And I found out very early that science is how you did that. Science is the process of learning about everything around you. And so in order to open my mind up, in order to appease my curiosity, I started learning more and more about science and seeing the way things work. And of course, at an early age, I saw someone doing what they call a magic show that was a science magic show, which is not what I do. I don't do any magic. But there were some explosions in there, and those are kind of fun.
I like how in having good fun, you will always try to add a little bit of drama. I mean, you make sure that your young assistants are wearing protective goggles and protective gloves and so on, and like to give a sense that we're just on the edge of danger here, although we're not quite doing something dangerous. That's probably a really good ingredient in making your programs as exciting as they are.
Oh, yeah, good point. Thank you. That does serve several purposes. It builds the tension on the excitement of what's happening. It points out that even the mundane can be dangerous. You know, I have a chemical reaction that I do in my shows when I have a young student using just dish soap. But I make sure that she's wearing goggles because even though it's just dish soap, it's still dangerous. If it gets in the eyes, it can hurt. It can cause you to stumble around and knock over something else that's more dangerous. So I try to remind that we always practice the number one rule of science. We always practice safe science. But you're right, that also does help build up the tension of what's going to happen. Because even in my shows, they're live shows, sometimes things go wrong. That's the nature of science. It doesn't always go the way you expect. So that's why we always have to be careful.
Right. And I know that part of the point of what you do is not just for people to come watch you perform and participate in that moment, but you really want people doing science at home. I've seen some things that you've done which kind of have the banner headline, "Try this at home," as opposed to "Don't try this at home."
Yeah, I took the "don't" and I cross out the word "don't" because I want, you know, I've had conversations with parents who say, "I thought I was going to take a nap because it was a children's show, but I realized it was a family show, and we're going to go right now and we're going to make that air cannon you showed us how to make. So we're going to go home right now and make that rocket you showed us how to make." Because I really want parents to get actively involved, because that's what our country needs, is for our parents to be setting the example. And I've had parents say to me, "I can't do science with my children. I don't remember." When my response is, we're talking elementary school science. You don't have to remember it. Learn it with them. It's all out there online. Just do it intelligently and safely, and you can have a lot of fun together. It's much better to turn off the television or turn off the internet or go outside and play with your children than just and that's more empowering in every area of their lives. Plus, it's a lot of fun for the parents.
And in some ways, the third of your core values that are part of what you do is in some ways the most important thing of all. Every child is intelligent, creative, valuable, and they need to know that about themselves.
Yeah. Yeah. I was, you know, and that was something that I added to the show after I began, because I was doing my shows, and there was a time where I had an elementary school audience in a theater. And I used to say, I would say to the volunteer I had, I would say, "You're a smart young man. Yeah, you like a healthy diet." And I would turn away and keep talking. And I had a young man on stage, and I said, "You're a healthy young man, yeah?" And before I said the next part, I said, "You're an intelligent young man, yeah?" And before I said the next part, he said, "No." And that floored me, because someone had told that child enough times that he's not smart, that that's what he believed about himself. But this is elementary school, a fourth grader, already believing that he's not intelligent. But when I got on my knees and I turned to him and I looked him in the eyes and I said, "You are intelligent. I saw it in your eyes, and that's the reason I picked you." And then I told the whole audience, if you ever want anyone to believe in you, you got to show that you believe in you, and you should, because you are magnificent. And that turned into a part. That's now a part of every show, regardless of what script I'm doing, what demonstrations I'm doing. I always take an opportunity to make sure that these students in the audience, the children as well as the adults, know that they are valuable, that they are intelligent, that they are creative, that they are talented, and that it's important to embrace that part of it.
Mm. So amidst all the explosions and the setting off of rockets and all the other fun is that very, very important message carried by Dr. Kaboom. A reminder to everybody, Dr. Kaboom performs at George Williams College this Sunday afternoon at 4 o'clock in Williams Bay for their series Music by the Lake. And you can go to musicbythelake.com for information on tickets. Dr. Kaboom, we wish you safe travels here to southeastern Wisconsin and wish you well with all of the performing that you continue to do across the country. Best wishes to you.
Thank you, my friend, and thank you for your time. It's been a pleasure.
Again, Dr. Kaboom joining us for part one of today's morning show here on WGTD-HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva, your gateway to public radio. Here's part two. It's... I am recording this interview. It is National Cerebral Palsy Awareness Day. And so I am so glad that I can spend a few minutes of this day with a man by the name of Bonner Paddock, who is an extraordinary inspiration to all kinds of people, but particularly for those who, like him, suffer from cerebral palsy. Bonner Paddock has not let cerebral palsy slow him down at all. As a matter of fact, he has gone on to accomplish much more athletically than most of the rest of us even dream of doing. And just some of what he has experienced in his life is told in a superb book called One More Step, My Story of Living with Cerebral Palsy, Climbing Kilimanjaro, and Surviving the Hardest Race on Earth. In this really inspiring book, Bonner Paddock talks about growing up with the harsh reality of cerebral palsy, but longing to just be like his schoolmates and like his brothers, and succeeding to some extent. But it was really only once he came to grips and fully embraced the fact that he had cerebral palsy, and particularly with the great inspiration of a young boy with cerebral palsy, in whose memory Bonner Paddock has stepped out on most of these adventures, that Bonner Paddock has built for himself an extraordinarily rich and inspiring life, which is told in this wonderful book. And by the way, his co-author is Neil Bascom, a very, very fine author with whom I had the pleasure of interviewing for his book called The Perfect Mile, which was the story of the quest for the first four-minute mile. He is the co-writer with Bonner Paddock, again, of this book published by HarperCollins called One More Step. Bonner Paddock, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you very much for having me.
For those of us who have people in our lives with cerebral palsy, we are probably especially astonished at what you have accomplished, because we think of cerebral palsy in certain specific terms, in terms of what a person with cerebral palsy can and cannot do. and you have certainly defied a lot of those expectations. Let's talk first of all about the way in which cerebral palsy affected you very concretely from a very, very early age. Tell us what some of the first indications were that something was amiss.
Yeah, absolutely. It was the, I have not very good leg coordination, so the best way I always explain my, how it affects me is if you haven't worked out, or if you've worked out really hard in six months and you go to the gym for the first time in a long time and you wake up the next morning and you're really stiff, that's kind of what I feel like every morning is my body, my lower half of my body really does stiffen up, and there's considerable kind of pain just with the rigidity of my lower half. So from my lower back all the way through my feet is I don't have as much flexibility or movement as the quote-unquote typical person does. So it's, you kind of have a very stiff walk that, you know, knees kind of go inward, and it's very noticeable just from the naked eye per se of someone that's going to be like, wow, okay, you know, there's something a little bit off right there. So for me, it's primarily it affects the lower half of my body.
Hmm. It was interesting. You kind of recount how long it took for doctors to come to really understand what was going on with you. I mean, you were the subject of one misdiagnosis after another. And I was especially surprised by the moment you describe when some doctor actually sort of blurted out words to the effect that you walk funny, or this young man walks funny. And it was actually, in a sense, liberating to hear a doctor actually fully acknowledge something that you and your family knew to be true, but which other doctors ahead of that had simply not wanted to or felt inclined to address. Tell our listeners about that moment.
Yeah, it's a very interesting moment because our family wasn't a very communicative family. We didn't talk a lot. We're very siloed. Parents got separated at a very young age. So there was a lot of that time where if it wasn't per se normal, it wasn't really discussed. It was just kind of been like, okay. And so the only time I ever saw a lot of these doctors was, you know, when I go into the hospital or anything, if I broke a bone or, you know, anything else like that, the basic stuff. So we didn't really like rush around everywhere because I was able to walk and everything else. So it was one of those moments where, you know, just when the doctors would take notice of it, if I walked, you know, for a good distance, they basically would make a comment that seemed like somewhere here and there. And I was really young, so it was really unfamiliar, mainly with me, but mostly obviously with my mom, that she was the one that was at all these. So it was this odd thing where we really didn't talk about it that much. We just knew that there was something different, and we never really could put a thumb on it for a long time until I was 11 years old, and that's when we got, you know, officially properly diagnosed and was able to get at least a beginning pathway of going to physical therapy and everything after school. Those are the things that then it became to be a little bit more prominent in my life, where it wasn't really talked that much, except it was noticed and commented by people that, you know, did you hurt your knee? Did you hurt your hip? You know, those are the type of things, because they weren't quite sure, you know, what I had.
Hmm. So for the most part, did your peers, I'm thinking like when you're in junior high and high school and you are playing soccer and playing basketball and so on, but doing so with this situation that was, of course, a serious complication, did they tend to know? Did you tend to share this with anybody, or did you just muscle through as best you could, and were you content to just have people think of you as just a bit awkward?
Yeah, we went with more of the bit awkward route, and it was something that we didn't, you know, I didn't want really anybody to know, and it was something that I was worried what people would say if I told people I had it. So it was something that grew into a really big secret of mine for almost 30 years of my life. So it was something that I could go out and do some sports and, you know, wasn't always the best player on each team and everything, but was really determined and stubborn. So that helped me kind of get farther than most of the kids, just with willing to outwork, you know, them for the effort for in sports and everything. But everybody always knew, it seemed like, now talking to them, looking back, they always said, yeah, you know, there was always something we weren't sure, but nobody ever spoke about it. Nobody really asked. So it was really kind of unknown, even to my brother, even into his 20s, which was surprising when we wrote the book and Neil got that from him in his interview. So even my brother didn't know I officially had cerebral palsy until he was in his 20s. It just shows you how siloed our family was and really poor communication we had amongst each other.
Right. Sometimes we will read the story of somebody who is contending with cerebral palsy or something else, and they really strive to live as normal a life as they possibly can. I mean, making no excuses for themselves, not setting limits because of that. And we find that really inspirational. I think what you're saying here is, in a sense, you and your family almost took that too far by not acknowledging the fact that you had cerebral palsy. And I'm guessing that your advice to, for instance, a young person in roughly the same situation would be to not quite muscle through to the same extent that they actually bury the reality that they have cerebral palsy.
Yeah, I think you said it exactly perfectly, is that it's one of those things that I think, you know, when you don't know what you have, but yes, you're muscling through it, you know, there's maybe some, you know, people can say, well, that's really admirable, but you know, I think it's that balance, and everybody can be an armchair quarterback, you know, Monday morning quarterback, you know, to say maybe we didn't. But the real true thing is talk about it, embrace it, but also then also make no excuses for it either. And there's that balance that I think is the ideal for any parent or anybody raising kids, no matter what they have, is that you got to keep pushing them and you got to let them be themselves. But you got to be able to talk about what it is, and if they do have, you know, their challenges, you got to address them, because we're all human. So at some juncture we do come across our own limitations or challenges, and being positive and addressing and talking about them is the best way for them to be comfortable that they know they have it, but you don't have to use it as a crutch.
We are speaking with Bonner Paddock, who writes about the reality of living with cerebral palsy in a memoir called One More Step, My Story of Living with Cerebral Palsy, Climbing Kilimanjaro and Surviving the Hardest Race on Earth. Certainly for you, a gigantic breakthrough in thinking differently about yourself and the fact that you had cerebral palsy has to do with meeting an extraordinary young boy by the name of Jake. Tell our listeners about Jake and how your encounter with him and his family made such an enormous difference in your life.
Absolutely. Jakey was a 4.5-year-old boy that had a very severe case of CP, couldn't walk or talk, and I had met his dad with the local charity here in Orange County, UCP of Orange County, that he was on the board of, and I had reached out to volunteer at. And through that meeting, he actually went home and told his wife about me, and he sent me an email and said, "You give us hope for our son, Jakey." And I was like the first person that had responded back to me when I began to start telling people that I had CP at about 29 years old. And that was a huge light bulb above my head, that people were accepting me and loving me for who I was. That if I could give hope to a family just by sharing my story was just mind-boggling to me, when I was just trying to be normal and just try to be like everybody else and, you know, hold down a job. And so for them, there was that instant connection. And I had only been and met Jakey in person like for 10 minutes of his life before he suddenly passed away. So it's just a bizarre kind of experience in terms of his family was the first ones to accept and love me. And then we just had this bond that we had shared, you know, in a short amount of 6-month period, but of acceptance and love. And for me, that was a lot of things that I definitely wanted and needed, and they were one of the first outlets for that. So it just was this instant bond.
My recollection is that phone call with the news that young Jake had died came at an incredibly dramatic moment. Tell us about the timing of that.
Yeah, it was the morning after Jake's dad and I had run the half marathon for the charity. They were the charity partner of the Orange County Marathon, and so he was running the full marathon for Jakey, who was was alive that day, and I was doing the half. But I stuck to him, and we ran the first part of the course together, and we talked a lot about, you know, what it's like for me. And I guess at that juncture I didn't know, but he was really having a hard time connecting with his son, and so he was talking and asking me questions to try to understand and learn maybe if this is what Jakey was maybe thinking about inside his mind, since he couldn't talk. So it was there's a really special, you know, few hours out there on the course talking with him while we're out there running and suffering and everything else. But it was just an unbelievable bonding experience, and so much so that I didn't train that much on it. So I called in sick to work the next day because I was so stiff. And I got the news from the executive director at UCP that, you know, Jakey had died that night, and it was just like mind-blowing and, you know, very emotional. And I just told him right then and there that I was going to run the full marathon that next year in Jakey's honor. So it was a very, very powerful moment for me.
I don't think we've actually touched on what actually gave you the impetus to embrace the reality of having cerebral palsy and of speaking about it openly and even publicly. I mean, a dramatic step really for anybody, but particularly for someone like you who had, in a sense, buried this reality for such a long time. What were the events that sort of came together that that put you into such a different place regarding your own CP?
It was getting to a point in my adult life where, you know, you really are noticing that I had a huge secret, and it's not a great feeling at all. It becomes like a lot of pressure or weight on your shoulders, and it wasn't a healthy feeling at all to say, at some juncture, I got to figure it out. But when you get so dark down in this, like, hole or whatever, you're trying to figure out, I don't even know how to get out. So luckily I had a great boss named Ron Seaver, and about a year after working for him, I walked into his office and told him that I had something to say and that I had cerebral palsy, and he was like, okay, Vaughn, man, that's great. Like, do you need any help with anything? Do you need a parking spot closer? And I was like, nope, I just want to let you know. And I just, like, ducked out of his office, like, right away. So it took a person that I really trusted in terms of the business world, and he's a great friend, and I knew that he would accept me, I guess. And so that was that started giving me the confidence that every job I got to talk to before they hire me. And then it just is the beginning of a snowball effect, pretty much.
So explain to our listeners how the running of first a half marathon and then a full marathon and then the amazing adventures which followed thereafter. But let's stick with just the running marathons part. A huge undertaking for anybody. I mean, an undertaking that would probably kill a lot of us, me included, were we to undertake it without proper training, certainly. And even then, it just boggles the imagination for those of us who are, in a sense, fully able-bodied. For you specifically, what were the most specific issues that your cerebral palsy caused? I mean, what were the ways in which this was even more difficult for you?
For me, the pain is very difficult, and it is a lot in my legs. And so what it is I have spastic diplegia, which means that, you know, my muscles spasm when the heart rate gets, you know, really high, or the blood, you know, increases in the leg area is the best way to kind of simply explain it. But my muscles don't relax fully, and then they're a lot tighter than most. So to use my legs to go out and do a half marathon or a full marathon when they're very stiff and rigid does a lot of damage to those legs, because they're not moving like the nice shock absorbers that they're supposed to and have flexibility and, you know, strong movement. So, you know, my legs aren't as strong as most people's. They're stiffer. So the muscles tear and they cramp up faster, because when they're tight, there's not as much moisture in them. So you have this kind of quick cycle of doing long-term things like a half marathon and full marathon are, you know, extremely difficult for, you know, someone with tight legs and those types of things. So it's a very stiff and rigid run on your body. For us, it just kind of hammers the body a lot more, especially the bottoms of your feet and your ankles.
As we read your book and the accounts of this, it's just incredible to think about somebody sustaining that amount of pain and, in a sense, also doing so much damage to their own body. I mean, one of the things you describe very vividly in this book is not just the pain of the actual running, but then the pain of the aftermath. Is there any significant risk that you have been, in a sense, punishing your own body too much, and in what has helped you try to make determinations about exactly how much punishment to, in a sense, inflict upon yourself?
Yeah, it definitely inflicts a lot of punishment, so much so that the doctors, you know, aren't happy when I go out and attempt these, you know, feats or stunts or whatever adventures. But it's one of those things that through my being, you know, talking about CP and then meeting so many families of kids both here and in Africa, you start meeting and understanding like the amazing gifts that I've got are these legs. As much as they may hurt each morning and they may be stiffer and, you know, maybe more pain when you run, like I've got the amazing gift to use them every day. And so if I didn't do all these things, in my opinion, I wouldn't be utilizing to the max, you know, these gifts that I've been given, and hopefully, you know, raise a ton of money and awareness for, you know, these awesome families that are out there trying to get motivated and need help out there. So it's kind of one of those hard things that you could say, okay, I need to stay and rest them because it's probably going to cause long-term damage to them. But if I didn't have these legs, I wouldn't even have that opportunity. So I feel like I've got an opportunity to go out there and really hopefully raise and push that they can inspire some other people to, you know, get out there and understand just amazing basic things that we take for granted, like legs or eyes or something like that, that a lot of these kids don't have.
Hmm. We're speaking with Bonner Paddock about his memoir, One More Step, My Story of Living with Cerebral Palsy, Climbing Kilimanjaro and Surviving the Hardest Race on Earth. So we've already talked about the fact that you were willing to undertake the grueling pain of running first a partial marathon and then a full marathon. And from there, you decide to climb not just some mountain, but one of the tallest mountains on Earth, Mount Kilimanjaro. This had to represent a step up of audacity, let's say, in terms of the kind of challenge that you were taking on. Explain how this represented a still more potentially dangerous undertaking for you, and what fueled your determination to do it nevertheless.
Absolutely. The stiffness in my legs obviously creates a lot of balance issues, and that's just kind of the coordination isn't that great. So put yourself on a mountain and you know that the summit's going to be at night and you're going to have to go through. It was basically some of my biggest fears, and instead of probably thinking it through a little bit more wisely, you know, I threw myself into it saying, the only way you're going to get, you know, address your fears is go after the biggest ones in the biggest moments. And so that's why I chose Kilimanjaro, because of its 8 days, it's, you know, almost three times as much long. It was like 64 miles to get to the summit and back. So it was a lot longer than the marathon. It was more days. So all of it was continuing to push both physically and then mentally, was seeing if I could address a lot of my biggest fears of what I've avoided for so many years with my legs and my balance and everything like that. So I would say that it was pretty naively that I went over there and did it with not enough research and talking to people, but it was something that I knew was way grander in scale. And it worked in terms of raising a ton of money for UCP of Orange County. So we raised over $250,000 for that attempt. So it worked in that end, but other ends, it still left me kind of in dealing with the wrong way, how to get out and get more comfortable with being yourself.
Hmm. One of the things that's, of course, a very harsh reality of any kind of mountain climbing, but particularly when it comes to that sort of thing, is that we're dealing with all kinds of physical debilitation, apart from the actual damage done to feet and legs and so on in the actual climb, but the fact of being at such a high altitude and having bodily functions altered and in other ways too. It's just a difficult place to live, even if you're not climbing. I mean, just to sit still in these extremely high altitudes. Was any of that exacerbated by the fact that you had cerebral palsy, or was that not a particularly significant contributing factor?
So I think what worried myself and the doctors the most was, as the altitude goes up, you know, my understanding and reading and everything and talking with them is, you know, your brain kind of swells when there's lack of oxygen and your body's looking for as much, you know, oxygen as possible. That's where you get the really bad headaches and everything else. And obviously some people, you know, have the edemas and everything that, you know, ends their life. And those were the things that concerned them most, because cerebral palsy, you know, is, you know, when random parts of your brain die. For me, when the umbilical cord was wrapped around my neck during the birth process. So, you know, we're going up there with a neurological disability, you know, per se, that controls the muscles in my legs. And what will that do, you know, if it starts, if the brain starts to overload or swell, you know, does that shut down my legs? What does that do for somebody that has CP versus, you know, someone that his brain is per se normal functioning? So there were a lot of those things that what would the altitude do at that height, and the length of time that we were up on that mountain for sure was our biggest concern. Hmm.
Well, you survived, and not only survived, but actually shook off the pain and trauma of that and decided to undertake something which was equally daring and audacious, namely to compete as an Ironman triathlete. Looking back, was this even a harder undertaking?
Yeah, it was both physically and mentally. It was, because it's all in one day, it's compacted, and it's now even the distance is greater than all of Kilimanjaro. It was almost double the distance lengthwise than Kilimanjaro was. It's all, you know, in 17 hours. So the length of brutality in one day, where, you know, being so tight muscles, we're not really supposed to be or able to do endurance events. You slam it all into one day, and you have to deliver that day. You can't come back the next day. That race is one day with 17-hour limit. So it compacted everything of a pretty massive smashing to the body and everything else in one day.
It was interesting. I think it was during the triathlon, but it might have been also in the mountain climb. But one of the things that would fuel your determination was not just thinking about young Jake and the way in which he was such an inspiration to you, but you also called upon, in a sense, darker forces, forces like anger, when you thought about moments in your past when, for instance, you had been made fun of or told that you couldn't possibly do something. Just say a word about that, and if you think that was what just had to be at that moment in time, or I mean, is that a good way to make this kind of amazing accomplishment happen?
It happened on Kilimanjaro, and it was when I was just so beyond exhaustion that I couldn't kind of force it away in my brain. So a lot of that anger and stuff started coming out on the mountain at myself, and, you know, just kind of, you know, talking into the air. So that happened on Kilimanjaro. That was the part that I didn't like. And then luckily, working with Welchie through Ironman, he taught me how to appreciate the journey and begin to, like, love and respect myself. So Ironman, it was all positive reinforcement and doing it for all these, you know, a lot of positive things that had happened in my life. So even though the two world records, people look at them, they were drastically different. One was fear-based and the other was love-based, with understanding where my life is going, being confident who I am, comfortable with my disability, all of that. That was the Ironman journey. The Kilimanjaro journey was all fear-based, hadn't dealt with anything, threw myself at it, thought it would be a good idea, looking for, like, that instant happy pill. And it just isn't there. So I had, between those two journeys, I had to really work on myself and deal with a lot of, you know, those issues that I had and let them all go. And that's why Ironman was possible through positive. I don't think I could have done Ironman, you know, with the anger and everything else. It was, had to dig deep for people to, you know, help and everything.
Hmm. It's really an incredible story. And you appear to look back on this gauntlet with very, very little regret. I mean, for all the pain which you have experienced, and the fact that probably a couple of times over, you could have perhaps even died. But this evidently has been well worth the effort and the sacrifices that it has represented.
Absolutely. It's worth all the pain and everything else, and hopefully with the book and the feedback that I've gotten so far from a lot of people, is they say it's just been very empowering for them to read something, and someone that expressed all their pros and cons of their life, is they say it's very nice to read that. So I said, that's fantastic, and it was totally worth all of it.
Hmm. What was it like to actually sit down and write this story and to kind of make sense of it, and in particular to kind of dig into some of the more painful aspects of your childhood and the dynamics in your family and so on. Was that difficult?
It was extremely difficult, and it got into the mental pain that I still had. And Neil did a great job of asking those hard questions about my past. And so I was able to, through many times it took to get it, but I had to go back and start to try to understand and relive those moments, explain them to Neil, and then hopefully deal with them now properly because I'm, you know, in a better place in my life. So I was able to kind of deal with those things and then let them go, forgive everybody, and just let it move on and keep staying focused going forward. So for the 2+ years we did the book, it actually was kind of my therapist was that book, and, you know, explaining and going through all those things, it really was empowering to just let it all out and let it go and just be like, it was, it happened, and let's all just move forward. So the mental, you know, it was actually harder than Iron Man, in my opinion, because it was mental wounds that I was dealing with, which turned out to be a lot harder to deal with than my physical wounds from Iron Man and Kilimanjaro.
Let's finish by talking about the foundation which you created, the OM Foundation, OM standing for One Man, One Mission. Explain the mission of the OM Foundation.
Yeah, we started that after we got back from Tanzania and climbing Kilimanjaro, just seeing that it's a global need to really address, you know, kids with disabilities. And I said, there's no way I'm going to be able to do it, you know, volunteering there and then finding another charity to volunteer in Africa. And I said, I want to form my own foundation that can support, you know, the disabled community here in the United States, but also help the amazing people that we had met in Tanzania when we were climbing Kilimanjaro. So what we try to do is raise money that, and then give to great programs that either already exist or start one with a partner charity that's already established in these regions. And it's to provide early learning therapy services, so physical therapy, speech therapy, and occupational therapy. And so whether it's with a school in Tanzania called Faraja that we're, you know, proud partners of, or, you know, here with UCP of Orange County with their, you know, Life Without Limits Center, we try to basically raise the money and then donate it into the community, either build the centers or support existing centers with those services.
Well, we applaud you on not only all that you have accomplished, but we applaud you for the good work of the OM Foundation. And we encourage people to take in hand your very inspiring memoir again called One More Step, My Story of Living with Cerebral Palsy, Climbing Kilimanjaro, and Surviving the Hardest Race on Earth, published by HarperCollins. Bonapadhyay, thank you for joining me today. This has been
a
pleasure.
Thank you very much for having me.
Monday on the morning show, we're rebroadcasting one of my favorite summertime interviews with author Justin Martin. His book is Genius of Play, The Life of Frederick Law Olmsted. Frederick Law Olmsted is responsible for designing some of the most beautiful parks across America, including most of the parkland which one enjoys in the city of Milwaukee. On Tuesday, a preview of the upcoming Pike River Rendezvous as we speak with Dan Joyce and Nancy Matthews from the Kenosha Public Museum. Also, Scott Sampson and his book, How to Raise a Wild Child, which is a book on how to encourage our children to care more about the natural world around them. On Wednesday, we rebroadcast a conversation with Hank Greenspan, talking about his many conversations with Holocaust survivors. Thursday, we look back 20 years to the devastating heat wave of 1995, which led to the deaths of nearly 700 people in the city of Chicago alone. Eric Klinenberg's book about that disaster is called Heat Wave, A week from today, Roger Abrams' book Playing Tough, about the intersection of politics and sports. Sunny today and a high of 86 degrees. Skies clouding up tonight with a 40% chance of some rain and thunderstorms, a low of 68 degrees. Saturday, partly sunny, just a 20% chance of rain, a high of 87 degrees. Cooling off just a bit on Sunday. This is WGTDH